Charles Mackey was the mayor of Whanganui for a remarkable 12 years on and off, and Charles Mackey had a spectacular fall from grace after he shot somebody whilst he was the mayor. This is a story from the 1920s. It is a remarkable tale and a story not well known in these parts. Paul Diamond is an excellent author and he's put together a fantastic book with not just words but images and diagrams and maps. Paul was very kind to let me borrow an hour of his time to talk about the remarkable story of Charles Mackey and his time in New Zealand, his time as mayor, his childhood, and his remarkable but tragically brief post-prison life. It's a fantastic story. It's a fantastic book. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoy me and Paul discussing his book. Thank you. I'm here today on my podcast, Different Matters, and I am interviewing Paul Diamond. Paul has written it's a great book and a fantastic story. He's called it Downfall, and it's the destruction of Charles Mackey. Paul, thanks for making the time.
Kia ora, David.
First thing I want to talk about, the architecture, the design of the book itself. This is not quite in a textbook fashion, but there are a lot of images, there are a lot of drawings, because a lot of autobiographies or biographies or stories about people don't have as much artwork in there. That must have added to the cost of it. What was the thinking behind that? Because I think whatever the thinking was, it was a really effective publication.
There's a lot of people who've helped me with this book, but one in particular was a boss of mine, Bronwyn Daly, who was the chief historian at the Ministry for Culture and Heritage for a while, and she's from Whanganui. She had a real interest in the history of crime and sexuality, and it was really her who encouraged me to sort of make a book out of this, because it started off as an idea for a radio program when I worked at Radio New Zealand.
Yeah.
And for various reasons, we didn't do that, but I did start working as a historian. And Bronwyn wrote an article where she made a big case for photos being used as sources. And I've always thought that was great. Not just as illustrations once you've written the text. I love the idea of the images being part of the narrative. So when this book sort of made contact with a publisher, it was really lucky for me that it was Massey University Press and Nicola Legger, who her and her team produced beautiful books. And she knew that I was interested in a book about Francis Hodgkins that Mary Kistler had written, which was where you could follow where Francis Hodgkins went in Europe. And I said to Nicola, I love that book. I think it's a beautiful design. And she, very fortunately for me, gave me the same designer, a woman called Megan von Staden, who's a genius designer.
If I ever write a book, I will use her. It makes it kind of a work of art. And given the main protagonist, that's probably, I think that might be appropriate.
And Gavin Hurley, when you mentioned work of art, Gavin Hurley's an artist based in Auckland and has done residencies in Whanganui. And I was lucky that I had time to sort of say to him, hey, have you ever thought of doing one of your portraits that you do of Charles Mackey? And he did a couple of versions. This was the second one. And as soon as Nicola saw it, she saw the potential for it to be part of the cover. And so with the beautiful sort of, 20s, 30s deco sort of
font that
Megan did. And then the way the images are all the way through and at the beginnings of each chapter meant we could get even more images in. And you're right, it did cost a little bit of money, but we were quite lucky. We got, good, generous support from places in Whanganui and Wellington here in Auckland. And, we had to pay for some of the overseas ones.
All right. So, for people who are not familiar with the book or the story, this is a story about the mayor of Whanganui in the 20s, in the decade leading up to the 20s, who had a spectacular and dramatic fall from grace. But before we talk about that story, maybe, Paul, let's go back to 1910, 1920, or 1900 to 1910, leading up to when Charles Mackey became mayor. What's your sense of what Whanganui is like? Because we're still part of the empire in one sense or another. We're a colonial outpost. There are some wealthy people in there. And it's into this world that Mackay explodes. So what's your sense of what Whanganui would have been like in 1910?
In the midst of a period of very rapid growth. And Mackay was born in Nelson, and his father was a school teacher at Nelson College, then came over to Wellington, and he was the headmaster at Wellington College. And then our father, Joseph Mackay, retired to Taranaki. And Mackay was sort of working on the farm. He taught at King's College, actually, for a couple of years in Auckland. But then he decided to do law. And he did law with Malone, who was the soldier at Gallipoli later. Mm-hmm. But Malone had a number of legal practices in Taranaki. So Mackay trained in Stratford. And then he decided to go to Whanganui at the turn of the century. And by all accounts, Whanganui was just going through this huge period of growth, because then Whanganui was so well sited. And if you imagine the country before the railway was completed, when we were still using ships to get around, when we had coastal shipping. And Mackay's responsible for introducing trams, electric trams.
Does this come back to that? I want to, because the thing that is remarkable about Mackay is, because he gets elected as mayor in, was it 1912, and he was
1906,
sorry, yeah. And he was 31 years old. He arrives in town, and in the image that I have, or the image I get from the book, is this is an established area. You've got some very established, very wealthy agricultural and possibly some commercial interests. You've got a council dominated by old bearded men, and you've got some wonderful photos of those old bearded men. And then this Charles Mackay turns up. He starts a legal practice. He marries the daughter of Isabella Duncan, one of the preeminent families in the area. And then bang, 1906, as a 31-year-old, he gets elected mayor. That it's difficult to kind of imagine how that would have felt, how that would have even happened. You know, this was, presumably this was universal suffrage, so there was no property qualifications, everybody could vote. It must have been a hell of a shock for the old guard.
He had a bit of a training in being on a road board, the Mataonga road board, you know, which turns out was very, his family, his in-laws, the Duncans, were very involved in that. So what the road, because there was the Whanganui town centre, but around Whanganui there was all this area where they had to talk about, well, how are we going to build roads and bridges and things like that. So they had all these road boards. And the one for Whanganui East, what we now call Whanganui East, where his in-laws owned all this land, was Mataonga. And he was on that board, and then he went from there to being on the council. Now, the board would have given him a bit of a profile. The book talks about how there was a bit of sort of skullduggery, what one of the Whanganui historians calls Machiavellian behaviour, like where he kind of leaked a document that showed the man who'd been the chair of the board, you know, perhaps wasn't running things financially properly. Apparently it wasn't true, but it meant the man didn't get elected. So, you know, he was a bit of a street fighter when it came to being on councils and boards and things. People accused him of using the board, you know, as a way of raising his profile. He's a person who sort of polarised people, but I think he was well placed to really make a difference in Whanganui at that point when it had this kind of surge of growth. And he managed to get electric trams introduced. Mm-hmm. When Whanganui was planning steam trams, I mean, we now know electric was the way to go, mm-hmm. but a previous mayor, Mr. Hattrick, who ran the riverboats, ferries, had gone to London and Paris and said, well, if steam trams are good enough for London and Paris, then they're good enough for Whanganui. But Mackay, I don't know why, but he had the sense that, no, it should be electric, and went out on a limb and got them through, and then for years was remembered as having done that. And that was the first place outside the four cities to get trams, an electric tram network. And so they had a gas plant to do that, and I think that later became an issue with this growth and this perennial issue of infrastructure, you know, population growth.
He was ahead of his time. Mm. You get a sense that he must have been an incredibly and intensely charismatic young man. He was a man with very little prospects.
He
had a good education. He started his own legal practice in Whanganui. He marries into the establishment. and then at a remarkably young age is elected mayor. There must have been something deeply magnetic about him, and he remained mayor because this is the other remarkable thing. Elections at that time were every year, and save for one year, which I think he stood down over some argument with an architect, he was elected continuously, right up until the end.
You're right. Charisma and energy. I think he must have had a phenomenal energy, you know, to be running a law practice, to be a father of children, to be a husband, and also be running a city with a lot going on.
And of course, all throughout that, there was another part of his life, because he was gay, that becomes a much more predominant feature of his life as the story evolves. But presumably, I mean, we don't know what he was thinking or how that was playing out. But he had that other aspect to his life as well. And I find that so you have, at the time, this charismatic, larger-than-life, dominant figure doing all of this stuff, and he's got this other aspect to his life. It's incredible. But let's talk about his time as mayor. The Sargent Art Gallery. This is just so impressive. So what did he do and how did he do it?
So Henry Sargent left a large sum of money for an art gallery to be set up. And Mackie, it wasn't just Mackie, but Mackie was really important in making that happen. But I think in doing that, he created a grievance that certainly I've seen references in newspapers to people being angry about him not going to war. Because, yes, of course, this is the thing that impacted on Whanganui and the whole of the country was the Great War, which began in 1914. When he came back to being a mayor after that two-year break that he had between 1912 and 1914. So he becomes mayor again, and then the war breaks out. The Lusitania is bombed, and they have riots, street riots in Whanganui, and he's hit with stones and
his behaviour there was exemplary.
And brave.
So just talk about what he did.
So there were anti-German riots around the country. They were in Greymouth and other parts, but they weren't anything like they were in Whanganui, where there was a young man, Conrad Heinold, who had a butchery store on Victoria Avenue, and people just destroyed it and looted it. There was the Dresden Piano Company down the road, who changed their name to the Bristol Piano Company, but it didn't stop people just breaking their windows. So, yeah, and Mackie kind of stood up and told people that it wasn't very good British behaviour to be doing this. But, yeah, it takes a lot of guts.
But he literally stood up, and he was injured as a result.
Mm. But he did enlist to go on the war a little bit later, and then he didn't go. And I think, why did you do that? Because I do know, actually, why he might have done it, because conscription was going to be introduced, and they, unlike us, didn't know how far conscription was going to go, because it only went as far as the single men. It could have gone right through to the married men like him. And historically, historians have said there were a lot of men like Mackie who suddenly enlisted, because it would have been a bad look to have been forced to serve. So a lot of people did do what he did. He did it in quite a high-profile way, you know, the Prime Minister.
But he was mayor. They're not going to conscript the mayor, surely.
Well, it could have. I mean, we know it only went as far as it did, but they didn't know that, you see, in 1916, 17. And there were big issues with getting enough people for the reinforcements that he was farewelling every other week in Whanganui. And you can see in the paper that he was called up. I mean, Malone was in his 40s. Malone was a career soldier, but you know, older men, men who were fathers and things, were going. So he was still eligible to serve. So Thomas Boswell Williams, who ended up taking over from Mackie when Mackie went to prison, sort of said, you know, I'm opposed to shams, you know, like when the mayor said he would go and then didn't. And then Mackie had a go at him and said, you know, well, you can't stand the limelight. And he talked about how bad Williams had been. You know, so there was real bickering. But I think that might have created a grievance. But anyway, not going to war meant that Mackie could lead this project to build that gallery, which is extraordinary. And it's really exciting for Whanganui that they're getting lots of support from Whanganui and further afield to restore that, bring it up to seismic strength and extend it.
So just for those who haven't been to Whanganui, or those who have and haven't seen the art gallery, so just give us a quick rundown of because it's impressive now, it must have been even more imposing when it was first built.
Yeah, there were very few art galleries in the country, actually, when that happened. It was opened in 1919. I think they started it in 1917. It looks like a sort of a mausoleum. It was actually designed by a young man called Donald Hosey, who ended up getting killed at Passchendaele.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran a big competition, a man called Samuel Hirst Seeger, who was a very famous architect from Christchurch. He ran that competition, and the brief was that it be a memorial. And it ended up being literally a war memorial because of Donald Hosey having died before it was even opened in 1919. But it didn't actually have a collection, a huge collection. Mrs. Neame, who was Henry Sargent's widow, she remarried after Henry Sargent died. She did travel around and bought various bits of art, including the statue copy of the wrestlers, famous sculpture of two men wrestling,
which also becomes relevant.
And but they, you know, they didn't actually have a big collection like they do now. So Mackey, actually, you can see in the archives in Whanganui, was writing to embassies all around the world, galleries all around the world, getting them to lend things. And also he got a big copy of cartoons to do with the Great War. And they're the original artwork. And
are the cartoons still there?
Yes, but one lot of cartoons was on a ship that got torpedoed. So they, you know, there's gaps in the collection. Those never arrived. But it's a huge big collection, and it will be great. I'm sure they will exhibit it, actually, because they're extraordinary, because they're the really big drawings and artwork that, you know, was then reduced for the newspapers. But it's internationally significant because they are sometimes the only examples of some of these artists' work.
There's three other things you credit him with: the Whanganui Museum, the Alexander Library, and even the War Memorial, which you said wasn't finished till 1960.
I don't credit... Those all happened after he went to prison and left New Zealand and died. But what I can, I think, credit him with is the creation of that sort of cultural precinct, which anyone who visits Whanganui will see.
This is the Queen's Park.
Okenamu, Queen's Park. So you go there and you see that all of these things are together there. And really the blueprint for that was created by him, with the sergeant being there. In the actual booklet for the competition, with the results of the, you know, who got the successful tender, in that competition, there is a drawing of what they were planning, and it was it was going to look like New Delhi or something. There was going to be the town hall in the centre, the sergeant on the right, and then the museum, and then another building. They would have had to completely flatten that hill. They only built one part of it. It would have been huge. So, you know, he dreamed big.
Imperial dreams. Mm. All right, so he also stood... it looks like as an independent candidate for the local seat in 1908 and 1911. And look at it, he polled well, like 15 and 25%. So there was some support for him. But
they had a double ballot system then. Weirdly, it ended just after that. But so you had to go through two ballots to, you know, the Liberals had an initial ballot, then you had to get another one. And he never made it through to the second stage. So it is odd that someone who had energy, drive, charisma, it didn't seem to translate to the national stage, which seems odd, because he had a high profile all over the country.
Well, no, I mean, you know, you think of, you know, mayors like Tim Shadbolt and possibly Wayne Brown and others that have quite a high profile in one area and maybe the electorate's sophisticated. Well, maybe, Paul, they just really liked him as a mayor and they didn't want to lose him. Let's talk about the Prince of Wales, the visit of the Prince of Wales, the future George V. This was a huge deal. He arrives in 1920, the Prince of Wales, and what happens?
You know, it was a real coup to be included on that tour, and also Whanganui got the only concert that was going to happen on that tour. And remember, that tour was to thank the Dominions, you know, Britain, Australia, Canada, Australia and us, and South Africa, I think, for the contribution in the Great War. So it was very sort of soldier-focused, which is why I think, you know, having enlisted and then not gone and getting offside with people would have been an issue for Mackey. But just everything sort of unravelled with this planning for the tour. You know, they decided to have a function at the Sergeant, but just for the young people of the town, and they were going to have claret cup, and that got the temperance people up in arms. But the really serious thing was the row with the soldiers over the concert, which, you know, they didn't invite the soldiers to, which seems really unwise. So they decided to have another concert. So the soldiers had their own concert, the mayor and the council had another concert. So the poor old prince had to go to two concerts. And yeah, and then they had this thing at the Sargent Gallery, and people just looted the food and the silver. They stole the Marius's silverware, and the hotel where the prince was staying, the boilers burst, so he didn't have any hot water. And we know from letters he wrote to his mistress that he hated Whanganui. He thought it was he went out drinking with the soldiers. So it was meant to make, you know, put Whanganui on the map, but, you know, Whanganui was a bit of a laughing stock.
So I missed that. The Prince of Wales went drinking with the soldiers.
Apparently he did, yeah. He didn't spend long at the Sargent Gallery, you know, on this big function that they got themselves.
That speaks so well of him, though. That's fantastic.
But, yeah, and okay. Hector Bolifo, who pops up in the story later, who was a gay man, who was a writer, who was mentored by Mackie, was covering that royal tour. And that is kind of seen as what gave him a ticket to become a royal biographer in England, because he'd spent this close period with following the prince up and down the country. Yeah, there was a railway strike as well, so the whole dates for the Whanganui visit moved a few days because they thought it might not even be happening. So there was a lot of chaos associated with it. And this is all just before this fall from grace, this incident shooting that leads to this dramatic fall from grace.
All right, so we'll come to that very shortly. But first, Walter D'Arcy Crespel, D'Arcy Crespel as he liked to be known, who was he? He was 20 years younger than our protagonist, but what else do we know about him?
D'Arcy Crespel was from a prosperous family based in Christchurch, and his family had come on one of those early ships that European settlers came to Christchurch. His father was a lawyer, made a lot of money out of land, and was farming in South Canterbury. And Crespel had gone to England to study architecture. And then when the Great War broke out, he enlisted in the British Army, and then he actually got shell-shocked and was invalided. But then he enlisted to the New Zealand Army, and then he was wounded and came back. So he's convalescing, and according to his family, he was travelling around his relations. The smallness of New Zealand, his uncle was the principal of Wellington College after Mackie's father. So he had an uncle in Wellington. He had these cousins in Whanganui. He had an uncle who ran the meatworks in Whanganui and was on one of the town boards. The town Whanganui had a lot of separate councils and town boards back then. So the uncle in Whanganui was on the Castlecliff town board. So would have known Mackie, who was apparently the family's solicitor. One of the sons in that family had also died at Passchendaele, and another son had to go and serve. And so, you know, like a lot of families in New Zealand, a family that were really impacted by the war, probably a bit traumatised by it. So then D'Arcy arrives, but we know that weirdly, the day he arrives, he's having dinner with the mayor and his cousin, who presumably introduced him to the mayor. But that's sort of a bit odd if you've never met the mayor, and you just rock up to Whanganui and then you're having dinner with him. And this mysterious cousin, who's never really been conclusively identified, I think I know who it was, but why, because he was never asked to give a statement.
Talk about the significance of the cousin?
Well, he's presumably the one who introduced Mackie and D'Arcy Crespel, and it would be good to know a little bit more about that, about why they did that, and that did they know that Mackie was homosexual?
Well, could you allude in the state that there is at least a possibility that some of Mackie's local political opponents were behind this?
It's a possibility, because sort of one of the questions at the core of this story is, you know, why did D'Arcy Crespel, who had relations in Whanganui, but he didn't live in Whanganui, we don't know if he knew the mayor, why did he take it on himself to blackmail the mayor about the mayor's homosexuality?
Right, well, let's come to that. Crespel's in Whanganui, he's 20 years younger, he's with the mayor. There is this odd story that the mayor, who's got a key to the Sargent Gallery, it sounds like an older man showing off to a younger man. What's happening there?
Well, the pair of them, we know from the court records after there was a court case, and really all we've got to go on is the statement that D'Arcy Crespel gave from his hospital bed after he got shot by Mackie, is that they had a series of meetings. They had that first sort of dinner together at one of the hotels with the cousin. Then there were a series of meetings, and there was this meeting where they went and went to the Sargent Art Gallery. Wouldn't have been strange for Mackie to have a copy of the key, I suppose, because he'd been so involved with it. Mackie, I'm sure, was interested in architecture. We know he was interested in art. And and people have sort of speculated that, you know, he would have loved to be showing this person who'd been in London and studied architecture and would have known, you know, would have found the architecture of the Sargent interesting. And then there were a series of meetings in Mackie's office. And I didn't realise till I looked at the file carefully, I think there were about 5 meetings in that office. So things happening over a period of time.
So it's a little bit confusing. All throughout this time, Mackie is maintaining his legal practice. And Mackie's practice was, you say he was a defence lawyer. Did he do commercial law? What was he doing?
I think a mixture, but you'd see him in the newspaper, you know, defending people on
whilst
criminal.
Whilst he was mayor?
Yes, that was his
So was
business.
A mayor a full-time job?
I think he was able to do both. He did get an honorarium for it, we know. But yeah, I think they all of the people on that council had their own businesses and jobs and things.
Right. So, and he was, so he wasn't meeting Cresswell in mayoral offices, or was he?
Well,
we don't know.
We don't know. Presumably there was some sort of a mayoral office. The building that was there then is no longer there.
You mean that the mayoral office?
The building where Mackie's legal office was has been demolished because it was burnt down in a fire in the 90s. That's in the street called Ridgeway Street, which was a big commercial street in Whanganui then. Further down that street away from Victoria Avenue is another building, which was known as the Diagon Building, which was built by owned by a friend of Mackie's, Diagon, who helped with the Sargent Gallery. So perhaps that was why Mackie had access to it. And upstairs there was an office with 2 rooms, and that is apparently where the meetings with Cresswell happened. It's another unanswered question, why he had these multiple offices. And this one would have been a little bit more discreet, I suppose.
maybe that's why. So, because there's a wonderful picture in the book of you in that office hunting down the bullets. All right, so let's come up to the critical moment. So Cresswell and Mackie are in this discreet office. Cresswell's evidence is that he became aware of some, I can't remember the words.
Certain disgusting feature of his character.
yeah. And then Cresswell blackmails Mackie.
He says, unless you resign as mayor, I'll tell everyone about this.
Yeah, and then they have a bit of a dance for a while.
Well, and I think Mackie sort of tries to buy time. And he also says, you know, my wife and children, what about them? And they need the money that I get from being mayor. And so Cresswell agrees to give him overnight, and they meet again on the Saturday, sort of around just before lunchtime.
And then what happens? Da-da-da. We're coming up to the critical point.
They don't make any more progress. And I think, yes, because I'm trying to remember the sequence of events, because it involves the 2 rooms. There was a sort of another room where there was an office, but it culminates in Mackie shooting Cresswell, and then, according to Cresswell, placing it in his hand to make it look like it was a suicide. But obviously Mackie wasn't very good at using a gun, because Cresswell gets up. Mackie goes into the room next door and sort of locks it or holds it, and Cresswell fires off all the bullets and then throws a chair out of the window and says, help, I've discovered a scandal. So, you know, all the people in the businesses down below sort of see this, and then come running up the stairs while Cresswell's got his bullet wound, and Mackie sort of says, I was showing him how to use the gun, and it went off. It's just sort of a weak story.
It's just the most hopeless murder. So the inference is, well, we don't know. We don't know why exactly what went through Mackie's head. But this wasn't a planned, thought out action. But why did he have a gun?
There had been death threats against him following on from the visit of the Prince of Wales. And the row between him and the RSA got so toxic, and it carried on after the Prince had left Whanganui, that they, and the RSA were saying really strange things, like that Mackie was kind of heard uttering disloyal things about the king, and that they were using foreign cars, you know, like maybe German cars, you know, for the visit. Weird sort of stuff that I've wondered if it was alluding to him being gay somehow. But whatever it was, it got him upset, because we know from his lawyer that the lawyer mentioned during the trial that, you know, I think it was like the Friday, the day before, Mackie came to the lawyer's office and was really upset about something that had appeared in the papers. And all I can find is the stuff about the RSA meeting and just still going on about Mackie and his behaviour with the Royal Tour. And there were people in the RSA who were friends of Mackie's and were trying to sort of shut it down and stop them doing that. But this group in the RSA didn't do that. And there's a sense of trying to get him, you know, wheedling him and just trying to get him to blow. And he did.
Yeah. His lawyer, a gentleman called Treadwell, there's a law firm in Wellington called Treadwell. Are they connected?
Probably related, and the Treadwells, it's still there. The Treadwell Gordon is still, you know, people connected to that original law firm.
Because I tried to work it out whether they're... Because you got a picture of the father and son, Treadwells. The judge, this is just... incredible. Well, we'll talk a little bit about the trial in a second, but the judge is Sir Robert Stout. So he was...
the Chief Justice, yeah.
But before that, he'd been Premier twice. So here you have a guy who, some years earlier, had been Premier, Prime Minister in effect, of the colony. He then became the Chief Justice of the High Court, or the equivalent of today's High Court. So he'd been a former Premier, and he was now... So this must have been an incredibly high-profile case for the Chief Justice to be presiding over it.
He just... I mean, remember, the country was a lot smaller then. I think there were about 1 million people in New Zealand at
that
time.
Small.
Apparently he'd examined Mackie for one of his subjects as a lawyer too. He was sort of everywhere. You know, when Mackie's wife divorced him after this court case, he was the judge for the divorce hearing. He was on the... I think he was there when
prisons
Mackie
board.
Was struck off as a lawyer. He was the head of the... He was on the prisons board as well. He was everywhere in New Zealand.
He was.
So, and I think they probably knew each other. And Stout at the case in Wanganui...
Well, he does. Stout explicitly says, "I knew you as a 16-year-old.
And because Stout was the one who sentenced him. There was the sort of trial the day before where not much happened really, because it was just the eyewitnesses. Cresswell's statement, which was dictated from his hospital bed but never signed by him, but signed by Mackie, was...
Why was there a trial if he pled guilty?
There still had to be a trial. They had to hear the evidence, the statement from Cresswell and then the statement from all the eyewitnesses, but it can't have taken very long. Then they adjourned, and the next day Stout ruled on the sentencing.
And Stout presided over the trial, presumably.
Mm.
Because this all happens really fast. So he has to resigns as mayor relatively quickly, within about a week.
While he's on remand. And also remember, they had to wait until they knew whether Cresswell would live.
Yeah.
Because the charge would have changed if it had been murder, not attempted murder.
So it's at this point that Treadwell makes a big case of the homosexuality, right? So then all of Mackie's past comes out. The fact that in was it 1914, he sought treatment for homosexuality, so he'd tried to get some help. Obviously, it's not going to work.
Well, that's important, because you were saying earlier about Mackie, you know, it being remarkable that Mackie was managing to have this career that he had and a public life, but was homosexual. And the reason we know that is because of this. Because of the defence team deciding, well, our best line of defence is to say he's gay, and that was then seen as a nervous disorder. And their argument was, he's had a relapse of this nervous disorder, he went mad and he shot this guy. And that is really interesting, and it's what makes this book different. It's why this book is kind of a forensic history of homosexuality. And we know that, and that means that, you know, for that, what is it, 6 years at least, he would have known. And, you know, of course medical specialists confidential, but as people who read my draft said, you know, all that time he would have been living under that knowledge that there was a risk that someone would know. And
but he must have known before then.
Yes, but we know, you know, that deciding in 1914, was it his wife? Was it him? Why, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, he took himself off to get treated by a guy with the same name, not a relation. Oh, well, he went to his GP and the GP referred him to this person who by 1920 was calling himself a metaphysician, Albert Mackie or Mackay, I'm not sure which pronunciation he used. He was in Wickshead Street, the Harley Street of Whanganui, you know, known and respected by all the doctors. I spoke to his granddaughter and she remembered him.
Yep.
Whanganui has had a bit of a history of sort of alternative medicine. Colour therapy was used in Whanganui. This guy was using what we think was, well, we know it was autosuggestion. And he also used hypnosis. And this is still used to help people stop smoking and things. It's a form of training your mind. It's not using the will, it's using the mind.
Mm.
And at that time, they were using it to help people stop being homosexual. And one of the mantras was, in every day, in every way, you're feeling better. And this granddaughter told me that her grandfather was the first electric masseur, masseur in Whanganui. You know,
the first what?
He was the first masseur to use electricity. He was involved in boxing and in Whanganui.
It seems absurd to us, but I think I read somewhere else that you wrote that, or you might have been quoting somebody else about we shouldn't look at history as just us in funny clothes trying to really understand what it would have been like to be Mackie, to have the secret, to be blackmailed, possibly, you know, because it sounds like it wasn't an open secret, but there was, it was an open suspicion that there was something about Mackie, his homosexuality was kind of alluded to, but never really a matter of public conversation.
Yeah, I think he's a person that polarised people and he made powerful enemies for various reasons. Whether it was that, I'm not sure. But what you're talking about challenges gay people in our time as well as other people, because people, of course, have sort of claimed him as a gay hero, but you've got to remember that this was in a time when there was no such thing as gay. You know, there's no age of consent for sex between men.
Yeah.
All illegal.
Yes,
and I think the marriage act had only, the marriage age had only just changed in the last a decade or two earlier from sort of being 13. It's a very different time in terms of how relations between people were managed. So that took me a while to kind of really try and imagine my head into that sort of world.
Yes,
and how dangerous it was for these men. And I have written in this that, you know, it wasn't necessarily the police you had to worry about; it was other gay men, because you.
Including Criswell.
So much to lose. And you do see these tragic stories of men dobbing each other in to save their own skins. And maybe that's another possibility in this story, of course. Because Criswell was gay, we later learn in the story. You know, it's quite a complex story.
And also the gay panic defence, although you make the point that in this case Treadwell turned that, and apparently the gay panic defence was only relatively in the last 12, 13 years killed. But Treadwell was claiming that because of the pressure that Mackay was under, that he'd had a relapse of homosexuality and that was the gay panic that justified the shooting. It's incredibly convoluted.
And that he was not in control, that he was just completely... you know, mad, and that too, I think that's the word he used. Not in his own mind, you know, and it just didn't wash with Stout, who didn't believe that, and he, you know, thought that no, you put the gun in his hand, you know, that shows you were still able to, you were still in charge.
Well, Stout had pretty strong views. He was, he believed in eugenics and all sorts of other great, and homosexuality was one of the things that he, according to Wikipedia. Which, of course, we all know is intensely reliable, believed that homosexuality was one of the things that needed to be purged out. But that didn't seem to... Well, I mean, so Stout sentenced him to 15 years hard labour.
Which is quite a harsh sentence for that attempted murder. But he seemed to be leaving the way open for an early release. And, of course, as we have just been saying, Stout was on the prisons board when it was set up, who made the decisions about who got out of prison.
So many convicts. Let's talk about prison. There is a wonderful prison. Wonderful prison. There are some wonderful prisons. I can talk about that. There's a photo of him, Mackie, in prison, and it's... You can just... There's something about the photo... resigned, you can see his intelligence, the acceptance of his predicament, maybe even his own decisions that have led them there. And I think that that leads credence to the decision to put some of that stuff in. You look at that, and because you've got the pictures of him as mayor, and then the pictures of him, you know, maybe a year later in prison, and it's quite shocking. And this is at the start, you know, because we a little bit more about how he declined in prison. But there are so many tragic things. His wife divorces him, changes her name, back to her maiden name, and alienates him from the children.
They all change their name too, yeah.
And you were saying that you met some of them, one of them?
Colleague I was working with on the radio program had two phone conversations with Josephine Duncan.
Yeah.
Who wasn't very happy about us making the radio program, but Prue, my colleague, got a really strong sense that it was out of a sense of defensiveness of her father. Not so much shame or anything, but just defending him, really.
So we'll talk about his release in a minute. Did they ever meet the daughters? So there were three living. So he had one son who died very young, three daughters.
One of the daughters went to the States and died in the 20s. She wouldn't have been around, but there were two other daughters. As far as we know, though, they never met again. I think his wife's sister visited. You can see that because Mackie's inmate file has survived, which is really good. And that has the list of everybody who visited, everybody who wrote letters, and also who he wrote to.
Yeah.
So, you know, thousands of letters.
Thousands?
Yeah.
I thought you were only allowed five letters. You make in there, I've got a note, there was five letters, it was a week or a month you were entitled to.
He got a special allowance at various times. I think it was almost like unlimited. And then his
family. So how was it? So was he writing them with his members of the public?
His family would then forward things on, or he would say in letters, you know, please, can you write to so-and-so? And we know this because a small number of his letters were censored. And when they were censored in those days, they were kept. So I wondered what these envelopes that were clipped into this file were, and they were the letters that he wrote but never sent. And then that was amazing because you got a sense of his voice.
Mm.
And it's quite a different voice to the voice of the newspaper reports of him as mayor or him writing a letter to the editor. This was really amazing, and asking his friends in Whanganui for any news about his daughters and that he'd tried to be a good father.
Yeah, it's really sad.
Quite sad. So in the prisons, the book tells the story of he was moved around different prisons. He was in Mount Eden. Well, he was in Whanganui, then he was in Mount Eden.
Wonderful place.
He spent time in Waikerea, Hautu, and also New Plymouth Prison, which was set aside for homosexuals, which meant all sex offenders back then.
Yes.
And that was being used for that.
He didn't like it there.
For right up till the 1950s. So they had a classification system then. They tried to put prisoners with different offences. It's puzzled me that because he was in prison for shooting someone, attempted murder. He wasn't actually in prison for being a homosexual.
No, but that homosexuality or that deviancy, as I record it, is really. I mean, the prison board makes a comment, and you quote it in your book, that Mackay, notwithstanding his high intelligence and great ability, was sexually perverted. There can be no doubt. It was so stated by his counsel when pleading for mitigation of the sentence, and it is clear that Mackie recognised his perversion and had consulted both doctors and metaphysicians for his treatment of advice. So that sounds like, I think that was when they were considering him for release or had given him for release. So that.
Those are very important statements because they show how central to them his sexuality was.
Yeah.
And they're the ones making the decision about his release. It's amazing though, isn't it? Because legally, he was never charged with what was it called? Indecent behaviour or whatever, you know, the terms for homosexuality back then. He was charged with attempted murder.
But there was that taint.
Absolutely.
That it's a corrupting element of the soul, or however they thought about it. But I thought that was really interesting. Mm. So it sounds like, it's kind of cool you have the pictures. So Mount Eden, as you know, I've stayed at Mount Eden, so it was lovely. Waikerea, you have the picture of Waikerea, and you know I've also stayed at Waikerea, and the facade is there. And then you've even got a picture of Hutu, which I've also had the pleasure of staying there. That's changed because that he spent 10 months. Is it 10 months in Hutu?
I'm not sure if it was that long or not, but Hutu's now part of Rangipo, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all...
It's all around them. They were Tirangi. Using prisoners to, what do they call it, the pumice land, you know, cultivate it, plant trees and things.
It's good for the soul. It is. It is good for the soul, actually, at least mine. Now, let's talk about his release, because that was... it was scandalous. So he'd done 6 years of a 15-year sentence. Our friends, was he Sir Robert Stout? Must have been. Was on the prison board. He is released early on the condition... Am I reading that right? He was released on the condition that he leave the country in the care of his sister.
Yes, and I only know that because of some correspondence in the file. Weirdly, on the file, the probation report with his conditions of probation is not there. And maybe it's because it was just the top thing on the file, but other documents sort of say that was the condition. Yeah, so, and they kept it secret. I mean, I don't think they made a big thing when any prisoners were released, but certainly it wasn't known until a month later when Truth reported it. Good old Truth newspaper, and yeah, that he'd gone to Australia and then to London in the care of his sister, who set him up in a new business, which I think was advertising, because I found the file for the company that he was running, an advertising agency in London.
And but
the leading up to the release,
that seems so weird, though. I mean, so you're saying we don't actually know whether leaving the country was a condition of his release.
Oh, no, I think we do, because it's referred to in some of the other correspondence.
So why would they do that? That seems really odd.
Well, there was an inquiry into his early release, along with the release of two other people, which the book talks about, and it got bound up with a political controversy and challenging the government. And they were alleging that the government was letting middle-class people who had money and connections and things to get preferential treatment and get released early. So there were two other people along with Mackie. What was good for me was that they did a review, the prisons board reviewed it. And so they give a summary of the case and what happened, and I think that's where the evidence about release on condition that he had under the care of his sister is. And also... What they say in that report is not exactly the same as what they said in Whanganui, actually, because, you know, Cresswell had discovered that Mackie was guilty of indecent behaviour with younger men. Well, that's not what Cresswell said. Cresswell said, I discovered a certain disgusting feature in his character. Lots of people have speculated about what went on. You know, did they have sex? Did one of them make a pass at the other? Or did Cresswell confront Mackie about some sort of scandal involving young men in Whanganui that he'd found out about?
Yeah.
Which, there's various bits of circumstances.
Well, and Cresswell may have known that because he was in that... he was young and gay. He may well have spoken to somebody who had interacted. I mean, who the hell knows?
Well, actually, a friend of his, Charles Carrington, wrote years later to a woman called Helen Shaw, who was trying to edit Cresswell's letters, and came across the story, and she tried to figure out what had happened. And Carrington said, oh yes, Darcy did tell me about this. And all I can remember he said was that he had a young friend called Ronald who had become involved with the mayor, and Darcy was trying to help. You know, save his friend. Well, and it's actually not inconceivable because the friend...
But how was he helping his friend by getting the mayor to resign?
By uncovering his homosexuality, and it would stop him then having any kind of connection with his friend, Ronald
Cuthbert,
who lived in Christchurch. And you sort of think, how at that time could you have had a relationship with someone? But Mackie did travel around the country a lot for local government meetings and things. And... You know, how could you be gay if you had such a high-profile role then or now, even, to think about it? Well, it's not such a big deal being gay now, but then it certainly was. But I could sort of see that it would be easier to be gay out of Whanganui, where you weren't so well-known, perhaps. I don't know. But, yeah, there's multiple theories, and we'll never know.
So he disappears off to London. The Adelphi Publishing Company... the name, was that his name? Was Adelphi a part of a... Because Adelphi itself has kind of its own sort of gay potential interpretation. Was that like a part of London? What was that?
Well, this Adelphi Advertising Company was based in Adelphi, which is that area in London by the Thames, and it's between Charing Cross Station and it's on the Strand and Covent Garden. And I realised looking at gay history books about London is that it was one of the big gay sort of areas there, coincidentally as well. He was living in Bloomsbury. I mean, all these sort of areas were very popular with gay men, but there were known cruising areas in that Adelphi building. Right. But, you know, having had what happened to him in New Zealand, I guess he would have been careful. But there's been some good...
He wasn't careful into Berlin. But yeah. The other thing is that Cresswell was potentially in town at the same time.
That's right. They overlapped a bit, actually. And there is a strange kind of reference in the prison file to... Well, the report from the prisons board in their investigation mentions a second statement that Cresswell gave, which I'd love to know what was in that. But there's a reference in one of Mackie's letters to a friend of the family going to London to meet Cresswell. And that perhaps is what was happening, was that they got this statement off Cresswell when she went to London. Because there's a person mentioned who was a big defence lawyer in Wellington who'd been at school with Mackie, and that he'd been sort of involved as well. I don't know what that was. I do know, you know, second, third hand from people who knew Frank Sargeson, who knew Cresswell, was that Cresswell apparently regretted what had happened, whatever happened. But that perhaps he was trying to help. And maybe that helped with Mackie's release, I don't know.
Maybe Cresswell unwound some of the damage that he'd done. The end of the story is so tragic. He then moves to Berlin.
He did have 18 months in London. You know, he was in Berlin not actually for that long, but 18 months, you know, a year and a half, and got to experience the Ballet Russe, which was one of the most extraordinary things in the history of dance. Very important with gay history as well. But, yeah, it only had two seasons. It had another season and then it ended forever. And he got that 1928 season. So it's nice to think that he got to see that, because weirdly, when he died in Berlin, one of his friends in London did an anonymous interview, and of all the things, they chose to mention that.
Yeah.
But apparently Mackie wrote ideas to Sergei Diaghilev, you know, this legend in ballet history, with ideas for ballets, which is kind of funny, isn't it? You know, you don't know, I'm from New Zealand, and I think you should do a ballet about that.
He was, he took up writing, or journalism. He was writing, it sounds like, both in London, but certainly when he was in Germany. So he was writing under a nom de plume and then under his own name?
You didn't normally have bylines then, no journalist. I would just say from our correspondent.
So disappointing, because you write, and I went looking for it, I couldn't find it, that... you know, the modern Germany today or something. And so he's in Germany, he's writing for the Wanganui Herald. It would have been just so magnificent for the residents of Wanganui to see their former mayor.
Well, they possibly were. I mean, he was certainly writing for the Palmerston North paper, the paper, the Manawatu Standard, I think it's called, was called then. But we know about the stories we know about because when he died, they said, this was the last story Mr. Mackie did. And they also referred to another story that he wrote about a ball in Berlin. And I found that by kind of tracking back and finding, you know, and it just said by a New Zealander in Berlin. But we know now that was Tom Mackie because they mentioned it later.
Should we just bounce back a little bit in time? There was another... which I enjoyed this so much. He was bankrupted and struck off the rolls of barristers. His bankruptcy was a mess. And if I'm reading this correctly, they took him back to Wanganui. And was he actually wandering around the streets of Wanganui, not as a free man, but what? Because that would have been so surreal.
No, I don't think so. But there is an interesting little reference in the file from the official assignee who didn't want that to happen. And then he said, I've talked to Mrs. Duncan and she does not want him back in Whanganui. Sort of, she's quite sort of mute in this whole story, but it was sort of interesting to know that she was not keen on her husband being back. There's a photo that I found. It's not in the book, but it's in these series of books called Memories of Old Whanganui. And it's a photo of a hotel outside the at the bottom of Victoria Avenue. And there's it's a very flash car. And there's a chauffeur and there are two men sitting in the car and there's someone getting into the car. And I sort of thought, oh, I wonder if that's Mackie. And it's definitely not. But when you look at the photo closely, there's a person hidden to the side. And I think that could be Mackie in it, because the guys in the car look like detectives and there's a policeman standing outside the car. I think maybe they were, you know, taking him around. He had to have meetings with creditors and things. So he was just there for a few days, 1 week.
But he was he was still a prisoner. He's a former mayor. He's shot somebody, and he's back briefly in town.
The prison in Whanganui back then was right in the centre of town too.
I know, but it was sort of just, you know, so surreal to be in that setting. Anyway, let's come up to the sad and tragic end. Describe his life in Berlin, what we know of it.
Well, he was, as you say, he'd resumed this career of writing and doing journalism. He was teaching English, which, you know, Christopher Isherwood did that. Jean Ross, who's the model for Sally Bowles and, you know, Cabaret, she was doing that. It's what the expats did. It's like, you know, when people go to Japan, they would teach English. In those days, the foreigners would go to Germany and teach English, which was much less commonly spoken than it is now. And sort of had this career. He was staying in a pension, you know, these, after the Great War, all these widows were poor and they were renting out rooms in their houses. Yeah. And that's where the foreigners usually stayed. It was cheaper to stay there than in a hotel. For some reason, he decided to locate himself in a place called Schöneberg, which is in the west, and it was one of the big gay established areas. Yeah. And when I actually looked at where the gay venues were, I realised that the three places he was living were right smack in the middle of that. You know, so that's interesting that he chose to locate himself there. And I think that's kind of evidence, along with what a woman called Blanche Bourne, who visited Mackie, she set up the Howard League and corresponded with him, and she wrote about him in a book later about prisons, and she said, you know, I have no reason to believe that his practices were any less perverse on release. I mean, so that's the language of that time. Mm. But she's saying, well, being in prison didn't stop him being gay. And I think, you know, plonking yourself in the biggest gay subculture the world had ever seen, with its own political rights movement and everything, was interesting evidence. So we just know what he was doing those last few days of his life, because he ended up being asked by a man called Sefton Delmer to help cover these riots that are in the TV series Babylon Berlin, at the beginning of the first season of that series. And these were fighting that was going on between communist protesters and the police. The police were very socialist politically and hated the communists. They stopped the communists having their annual May Day celebrations, but they had them regardless. And it turned really nasty because the people were starting to be shot and killed. No one on the police side was killed. but anyway, on the third day, Mackie was asked to go and check out where these riots were happening, and ended up being in the wrong place at the wrong time, near midnight in Neukölln, in one of the places where these riots were happening, and he was shot outside a shop, which was a Jewish clothes shop, which is now, it's still there. It's a chemist. And so he's buried in Berlin. Yeah, I've been there a few times. Friends now go there and take photos and send them back to me of them on the spot.
That's
so as a result of the big inquiry, because back then it was a really bad look for a foreign journalist to be, and he was known as a British subject born in New Zealand. So the British, you know, we didn't have an embassy in Berlin, but we asked the embassy in London, the Foreign Office, who asked the embassy, the British embassy in Berlin, to investigate this, or to get the police to investigate it. So the police and Sefton Delmer both went around Berlin getting statements from people. So I was able to reconstruct what Mackie was doing, you know, teaching the children of an American film producer English, then going and buying English language books, and then writing stories and things. And so,
He was living his best life.
Yeah, it's just so tragic, isn't it, that it was only that short period. I think he arrived there in October and this shooting happened in early May. And Berlin, you know, would have been an edgy but a really exciting place to be.
Oh, yeah, and that interwar period, the Nazis were kind of there but not because...
Yeah. Just starting to rise to power and they were quite
happy. This was 1929 he died?
And they were keen for there to be division between the socialists and the communists because what happened was they just came through the middle and managed to get into power that way.
Has Graves been lost?
Yeah, well, in Germany, like some of the European countries, graves are only rented. So the cemetery where he was buried, you know, was a church cemetery and then it became a city cemetery. But then, they have this policy after 20 or 25 years, they reuse the grave. So unless someone re-rents it, you can't, it just gets, and they don't apparently traditionally embalm either. So they're like eco-burials. The family was sent a photo of the grave, which is in the book.
Yeah.
There are descendants who still live in Tekofata, and that's the one thing they had about this relative that they knew a little bit about. But they, and so they very generously let me use that in the book.
Paul, I really enjoyed the story. It surprises me this isn't a better well-known story. I think the other thing is interesting how... I can't quite decide how I feel about Mackie, but I don't think he shot somebody, probably not with the intention of killing him, because if his intention had been to kill him, he would have shot him two or three more times. It sounds like it was a completely, and if you look at the arc of his life, you know, it was an incredible life, one catastrophically bad decision.
I think I've created a new folk hero. I do think, though, the more I look at Mackie, he would make me a bit nervous. He'd be very good company. I think Cresswell has taken me a long time to come to terms with. I think Cresswell is interesting. We haven't talked about how Cresswell had quite a interesting life after the shooting, became quite famous as a poet and a prose writer, but actually very important in terms of his support for other writers. And as Nicola Leggett said to me when we were writing this, these two men have got different timelines. Mackie's ends in 1929. Cresswell's goes on to 1960.
Yeah, he was friends with Sargent and everything.
Yeah, partly why this was hard to write, because those timelines are not the same. The two men, you know, their timelines overlap, but they're quite different. But, yeah, I think a lot of people know about this story, and it catches people's attention. I'm like, oh, the mayor shot someone who blackmailed him because he was gay. But beyond that, finding out what was happening underneath and around that has been the harder job, and that's why perhaps this has taken so long, and that this is the first book that people have managed to do. There's been some plays and things, and it's been referenced in other things. It's in some of the gay histories, but there's never actually been a book about it until now. Maybe that's why it took 18 years.
You 18 years.
Yes. Yeah. Starting the radio program that became.
You've written other books.
I think other books were written in the time it took to write
those. I really enjoyed the book. It's called Downfall. It is still. It's in bookshops. When was this published? Last year.
November 22.
It's a great story. And the other thing I like about it is the book itself is beautifully done. The pictures are fantastic. The images are great. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you all too. Thanks so much.
Thanks.